Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another foundational fantasy episode. And this time, I've decided to do something I haven't done so far, and that is to revisit a book that I've previously talked about on the podcast. Now, to be fair, we talked about the book for maybe 7 or 8 minutes on the podcast that I did with Dr. Audrey Isabel Taylor, author of Patricia A. MacKillop and the Art of Fantasy Worldbuilding, when I did my zoomed out episode about Patricia MacKillop. But one of the books that she recommended that I read in advance of that episode was The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, and I just loved it. And so I've read it a couple times since then, and I put out a plea on the Fantasy Faction Facebook group to see if I could get a couple volunteers to come on, and I did. So joining me are Karen Beck. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
And Rachel Young. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me. I appreciate it and dealing with my kicking this down the road a few months. Sorry about that.
No problem.
So let's sort of go one at a time. We'll start with Karen. Just sort of tell me about yourself as a fantasy fan.
I've always been an avid reader. Hmm. And I started out probably fairly predictably for a young girl in the 60s reading Nancy Drew and that sort of thing. But then a friend of mine introduced me to fantasy, and I immediately became hooked. And I read every day. I am a very fast reader. I am voracious, and I cannot stop. I used to buy the books, but I had to be careful about how much I spent, so I had to wait for the hardcovers to become soft covers. But years ago, I can't remember if it was Barnes & Noble or another bookstore, they used to have a discount card called Other Worlds. Mm. And that's how I would go save up my change in cash and then go probably once a month or once every 2 months and then walk out of the bookstore with like 8 or a dozen books. Mm-hmm. And they were my gift to myself and my prize for getting my homework done, or when I was in college, getting a good grade on an exam. I love from one end of the spectrum to the other. I like science fiction. I like fantasy, punk, urban fantasy, just about everything that you can think of. And I've read most of the authors and most of the traditional, Lord of the Rings and all the ones that you start off with, and then have kind of narrowed a little bit, but still pretty broad in my tastes. But yeah, fantasy and science fiction is the bulk of what I read at this point.
Nice, nice. Same. Rachel, same question to you.
So my history is a little different. I grew up in like kind of the 80s and 90s, and my introduction to fantasy actually was more through animation. I'm an avid animation fan, and that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. So, animation films are almost entirely fantasy stories, a lot of fairy tales. So I grew up in that, and it wasn't really until like middle school that the first fantasy book that I read was actually an assignment for a class that I was taking. And I think it was Searching for Dragons, Patricia C. Reed, the second book in that four book series. And from there, I just started, I don't remember buying the books for myself or if it was my mother who bought them for me. This is how The Forgotten Beasts of Eld got put in my hands this way. And I continued to read all through high school and so on. And I then did pursue a career in animation, but it didn't, the projects at the time were not, what I grew up with. It was like the South Park era where that kind of crude humor and very, just not fantasy at all. And, so on the side, I started writing and illustrating comic books that were all fantasy based. And I've continued to do that up until now, under my pen name, RC Young. And I continue to read. I for a long time, I didn't read. And then I joined a book club, and it's not a fantasy book club, but it was just a regular book club. And I'm always the type of person, like anything you put in my hands, I'll read it. I'll give anything a shot. But as I grew accustomed to reading very rapidly again. I started, okay, I read this in 2 weeks and I only needed four. So now what I'm going to read the next 2 weeks. And that's how I, and then I started picking up a little bit of more fantasy recently again.
Nice. Okay. So on my continued project to crowdsource, what is fantasy? Karen, why don't you go ahead on that one? Can you spitball us a definition of fantasy according to you?
Fantasy to me is anything that you use your imagination to come up with. You know, even the urban fantasy, you know, where they take the United States and put it in the future, or even if it's the current, and they take a real place, but then all of a sudden you've got werewolves or the Fae or whatever, and you put that into that circumstance. So, you know, any of those to me, anytime you take either something completely, totally made up or something that starts in the real world and then you add something you came up with into it, that to me is fantasy. So whether it's space or, you know, the United States or someplace in the world or a place that doesn't exist at all, to me, that's all fantasy.
Nice. Rachel, why don't you take a crack at it too?
So I've often heard that, what is that? Sci-fi is a subgenre of fantasy. But before I ever heard anyone say that, I always felt it was the other way around, that fantasy is a subgenre of sci-fi, because I think of sci-fi as anything that's not science fact. So anytime you're imagining anything or putting anything that doesn't exist into a story, I feel like that qualifies as science fiction. So there's, you know, space, future sci-fi, but like fantasy is kind of like less of a technological fiction and more of a biological fiction, that you're like inventing races or magical abilities that some people have that don't actually exist. So that's one of my definitions, I guess. And then another way to kind of separate it from other sci-fi is, I'm also reading the book, the Patricia A. McKillop and the Art of Fantasy World Building. And I was just reading the chapter about legends, and I kind of agree with the author in terms of how they separate out the definitions between a myth, a legend, and a fairy tale. So I think that modern day fantasy, like all three of those count as fantasy, and then modern day fantasy includes elements that you find in mythology and legends and fairy tales and folk tales, that those elements kind of reappear there.
Nice. Okay. All right. And then finally, like, what is it about The Forgotten Beasts of Eld that is foundational fantasy for you? And Karen, go ahead and start.
Well, it is the book, the first book in fantasy that I ever read. I was in junior high school when it came out, and a friend of mine had already gotten into the genre. Again, I was mostly reading other things, wasn't aware of fantasy, although I was watching, Star Trek on TV and stuff like that. But she introduced me to the book, and I can't even really explain it. To me, every word in that book is beautiful. And the funny thing is, so at Christmas, my parents were looking for something, you know, a bunch of different things, and they knew I was an avid reader. So they were looking for a book to buy me and couldn't find The Forgotten Beasts of Eld anywhere. So they ended up actually buying it from my friend. And I know not everybody on the podcast can see it, but this is the book right here. Nice. That I still have, you know, what is it, 50 something years later? This is my copy. It's very well worn. It exploded. That's what started the whole thing for me. And I know for a fact that it won an award when it first came out. Other authors have utilized it. In fact, I just read a book that came out last year called Never the Roses by Jennifer Lambert. I guess that's a second name for her. She also writes under the name of, and I don't know how to say this, whether it's Jeffy, I'm not sure, Kennedy. but she writes under the both those names. But she wrote Never the Roses under the name Jennifer Lambert. And she literally in the book says that, I know you're going to see pieces of the Forgotten Beasts of Eld in this book because it, again, this is 2025. She's writing about something that was printed in 1974. And it's still influencing her writing and still influencing other writers. To me, you could literally just pick up the book and open it at any point in time and read a paragraph. And the words are so beautiful. The way she says things is so beautiful. I know she spent some time, her father was in the Air Force or something like that. So she spent some time in Europe, Germany, and places like that. So you can imagine she got influenced by the Brothers Grimm and stuff like I just think it is one of the most gorgeous books that has ever been written anywhere in any genre. And then I went on to read her The Riddle Master of Head and that series. And again, that's another one. I have probably read that series and Forgotten Beasts of Eld probably at least once a year. I like to read my books over and over again because I love revisiting the worlds. And to me, The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, just beautiful, gorgeous. Love it.
Yeah. How about you, Rachel?
Ditto, kind of. But so I first read it probably also in middle school or maybe freshman of high school, something like that. And it was also, yeah, it was one of the most like romantic stories that I had read. And it was a book that I had read over and I read it over and over again. I read it a lot during my teen years. And then as I grew up, it was like a book that I carried around with me. And there were so many other fantasy books that I also had read that as I got older, I would reread them and I'd be like, eh, this isn't for me anymore, you know, and they all just kind of slowly dropped my attention. But this was one that I would revisit, like, and it would start to stretch. It would be like every 5 years and every 10 years. And like every time I was about to read it, I was like, I have such fond memories of this book. I am holding it like so high. It couldn't possibly be that good. And I'm misremembering it. And if I read it again, I'm going to ruin how I feel about it.
Spell.
And every time I read it, I'm just like blown away. I'm like, I was so wrong. It's so good. Definitely worth reading every single time. But yeah. I've always been so, as far as the fantasy genre, I've always been kind of fringe. And this is a book I was reading it in the 90s and nobody had ever heard of it. I don't even know how my mom or whoever picked it up. Like, I don't even know how it found its way into my house, into my hands. But it was something that like none of my friends had read it. Like, nobody knew about it. It was just kind of a personal book for me. It was a personal love. I have a younger sister who's 3 years younger. She would read it and we had a lot of things in common. And it was kind of like this shared thing that we enjoyed. And over those like teen years, we would pick up a few of McKillop's other books and we would, you know, we would share. She would buy some and I would read hers and vice versa. But none of them stuck out as much as that one. That one just is above and beyond. And so I'm ashamed to say that I've never read the Lord of the Rings trilogy or a lot of the other more popular series. And it's really cool being here today and talking about it because it was always kind of like just like my dark little secret thing that like nobody else knew about. And now that like the internet exists, it's really cool to reach out and find out like, oh yeah, like there's a lot of other fans and there's like this whole history that I didn't even know about it and stuff.
Nice. I came to it for the first time in 2023. I talked about this, I think, on the episode with Audrey Taylor, Dr. Audrey Taylor, who wrote that book we referenced earlier. And so I had never heard of Patricia McKillop. I had never heard of The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. And I think I started reading it on a plane when I was traveling someplace. And I read almost the whole book on the flight just because it was so easy to read. Such a pleasure with the word sentence to sentence level prose is so good. The descriptions are really great. And just the way she created the world of the book and then inhabited with so many characters that I thought were just really, really well drawn. It was very, very engaging. And so I immediately, I think I had it on loan from the library, or I bought a cheap ebook. And so as soon as I finished it, I went and looked, and I found that there was a 50th anniversary hardcover coming out. And so I pre-ordered it. Or no, I think I ended up going into Barnes & Noble and just picking it up off the shelf. But so I have it there, and I bought the audiobook as well. So I have it in three formats for all my needs, you know. And the 50th anniversary hardcover is just beautiful. It's got a great cover on it. I just recently read it to my mother. My mother is dealing with dementia, and so she has a hard time reading now. And so all of I and my siblings take kind of turns reading books to her. Sometimes there's more than one book going at one time, and I'm not sure how well she follows any of them, but she likes to have us read to her. And she really enjoyed this one as well. Every time we'd sit down to read, I'd say previously, you know, and kind of recap where we were in the story. But that was a real pleasure. And then after I finished that recently, I listened to the audiobook again, just to let it soak in a little more. Okay, let's talk about, you know, what the book is actually about. Do either of you feel strongly that you want to tackle the plot recap, kind of?
I can do it. I actually just read it again over last night and this morning. Nice. It's only 166 pages, I think, so it's not a very long book.
No.
In the grand scheme of things. But it is about the protagonist is a woman who is a wizard, and she lives alone up on the mountain, Eld Mountain, and she collects through her wizardry a number of different species, animal species for the most part, is what they look like. There's a black cat, there's a golden lion, there's a boar, there is a dragon, a swan, and a falcon. And I think that's all of them. And they each have their own abilities. Most of them only talk to her, mind to mind. Siren the boar is the only one that still has a voice that he can talk to other people as well. And one day she hears a knocking on her door, and it's a soldier from one of the kingdoms, the Searles, that he brings her a baby. And supposedly it could possibly be his brother's baby with the wife of the king from another kingdom. And they're fighting a war and they're losing. And they decide to bring the baby to her because her mother was from another kingdom. And so they decide that she's the safest place for the baby to go. And so she raises the boy, and then they come back looking for him again. And of course, they want to use the boy in their warring. And she's like, nope, I don't want that to happen. That's a terrible thing. And so she doesn't want to, but then the boy finds out about the fact that his father might be a king. And so he wants to meet him. She allows that meeting to happen. And he eventually goes to live with the king. And the king wants her to go live with him as well because she's beautiful and powerful. But she's like, no, I'm not going to be in the middle of this whole thing. I will not fight against you because you've got the child that I've raised, and I'm not going to fight against them because I think she had feelings even from the get-go for the man, Corin, who brought her the boy.
Yeah.
Has bright red hair.
Yeah.
So unfortunately the king is, it's not that he's a bad man, I don't think, but he's scared. He's fearful.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like the fact that there's this powerful woman out there that could conceivably, take away his power, even though she doesn't want to hurt the boy.
Yeah. Let's kind of discuss around all of that before we move on to the, because that's kind of the setting all the pieces in place, right? Before the real plot sort of kicks off. So let's talk a little bit about that. And Rachel, if you want to talk sort of about the first, I don't know, that's maybe the first third of the book, if that.
Yeah.
Because like you said, it's a relatively short book, and so things move along pretty quickly, at a good pace.
It's one of the things that I think is unique about it and why I like it so much is because it's so simple and it's so like small in terms of like the number of characters and the locations. It's very It's very tight plot. And I think one of the, a big point of this part of the story is that Dreed, the king, is afraid of her specifically because she was able to call him. And the fact yes. that she has, not that she just has power, but that she could control him even from a distance. And so I think that's a lot of where his fear comes from and becomes a major part of his future actions against her.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to talk about is Sybil's abilities, right? Because the main way her sorcery seems to be displayed is her ability to call, because that's how she has this menagerie of fantastic beasts. And I do want to talk about them as well, especially Siren, because there's one question that I have for both of you we'll get to at some point. But I love that all of the beasts have their own kind of personalities. And I love when Corrin shows up. I can't remember if it's the first time he shows up or if it's the second time, when Guild, the dragon, says something like, "There's a cave in the mountains where no one will ever find his bones." Basically, just say the word and I'll get this guy out of your hair.
Yeah.
Sybil's kind of like, no. But yeah, let's talk about the beasts a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the things that Patricia MacKillop does so well, and why I find other books disappointing, is she does such a great job. Each character is distinct. It's not like she's taking one character and then changing a couple of characteristics and saying, okay, this is a different person or this is a different character. Corrin is Corrin. Sybil is Sybil. Siren is Siren. Guild is Guild. I mean, they're all such distinct characters. And I find sometimes in newer fantasy that the people, they blur, you know, from one book to another, or even in the same book, if they've got 15 characters, then only 5 of them really have a true distinct personality. And the rest of them are kind of like caricatures of each other. So that to me is frustrating and boring. And that's why I throw it into the do not finish pile. But I think Patricia MacKillop, in this book and in other books, she has such a great grasp of personality to make each character a distinct being.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rachel.
You know, I would agree with that too. And I think, again, that's kind of the advantage of this being such a small set story, is there only are so many characters. And this is one of her earlier works. So I think it, you know, from a writing perspective, it's easier not to blend characters because she's only worked with so many so far. And as far as your question about, well, I think you mentioned her powers and how they work. And that's one of the interesting things about this book, is that it's fantasy. I mean, there's dragons and so on, but really magic wise, we only ever see them using this power to call people or animals, either one.
Yeah.
Because even the wizard that shows up later, I think we only ever correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misremembering, but I think we only really see them using like this telepathic mind control kind of power. And that's really the only magic in the story.
Yeah. I mean, Sybil does use her kind of mental powers to blank out Corrin's memory at one crucial point. But it's sort of a, you know, it kind of falls into the same category of power as the call. But she's called all these beasts to her, right? Or her father or grandfather has before, and now they're bound to her.
Right.
But it's
they
not,
have
it's,
their own powers too, that are not, I don't, true. Well, I guess they're still sort of mind powers, but, you know, obviously Guild the Dragon can fly, and the Swan can fly, but they kind of use, to a certain extent, mind magic, not necessarily calling, but to, that's why they distracted them from the war.
Right.
And they get, they chase after these beasts because they don't have the mind magic that Sybil has.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I meant more in terms, because like she uses the word wizard, right? When you think of a traditional wizard, there's like a lot of different magic involved, but really the humans at least are really only using this kind of telepathic mind altering type of powers.
Right. And then for the more mundane, you know, love potions and that kind of stuff, you go to Melga, who's the village witch, right?
And apparently her magic does work. I mean, she does say, well, you know, she brought me a perfume, and so now she's going to be jealous and, you know, for the rest of her life. Melga definitely does have other abilities. And I know the fire in Sybil's
Hearth, yeah, is the green.
Yeah, it's green for some reason, which isn't a typical color for fires, needless to say. So
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. So it's kind of like other magic exists, but it doesn't like play a part in the story, really.
They don't talk. That is definitely a focus. You know, like you said before, it's, you know, a few number of characters, a small geographical area that's being talked about, and a small amount of powers per se.
Yeah.
So, which if you've only got 166 pages, then I think you have to probably limit it to a certain extent and not go too crazy with places and people and powers, but she certainly takes full advantage of those 166 pages.
Yeah, well, I think that's impressive. Like, it's short. Sometimes shorter stories are better just because they're so precise and there's no time being wasted. There's no filler chapters. It's just everything matters. You know, everything is important and is written like it's important.
Yeah, I mean, and some of it too, I think the length of the book, it makes sense for it to be shorter and to kind of skip time because of the nature of the geopolitics of it, right? Where you have this baby, Tamlorn, who's born, and then for him to become a cog in the machine, or, you know, a piece on the chessboard of Eldwald, he kind of has to come, not necessarily to his majority, but I think he's maybe, I don't know, 13 or 14 by the time the book is done.
16, I think he might be by the end of the book.
Is the first gap is like 12, right? From like the end of the chapter one to like the beginning of the real story. And then, I don't think it gives specific, because I think the last time I read it, I was like, this feels like several years passing.
And of course, you know, her power of calling is very powerful because people don't even recognize that they're feeling it, right? Dreed just shows up on her door,
right,
and doesn't know how he got there, and that's one of the things that I think feeds into his paranoia later on,
right?
Where the same can't be said for Corin, who she seems to call subconsciously in some way, and he's an interesting character as well that I do want to talk about.
I was just going to say, he seems to also know that he's being called. Like, I don't know if he knows it the moment it's happening or by the time he gets there, he's like, oh, I've been called. I don't know. But he's so familiar with magic and all these myths and legends that he just kind of has this inherent knowledge about it that is never really explained how he learned about all these things that he knows. But that
he does mention once that he's the seventh son of a seventh son.
Sure.
Oh, does it?
Yes, yeah. It's very, very, you know, it's like wishes by.
Yeah.
But he's the seventh son of a seventh son. So that may be, although, it is pretty amazing that he knows, he's like, you know, that's Tur or that's Jules or that's whatever. He knows these things almost instinctively, which is part of the reason why she's so blown away by him, because he knows things that she's like, wait a minute. That's only written in one book, and I have the key for it. How do you know that?
Yeah.
And
I love his answer every time, too, is, I know.
Yeah.
Man's like got to keep his mystery. Yeah.
I drink and I know things.
Yeah. Let's see. I don't know where I wanted to go from there, but.
Sirin or Corin or.
Yeah, Sirin is interesting, and I do want to. I don't want to kind of get into it, but, you know, he repeats several times a particular riddle / prophecy kind of thing to her. And at some point before we sum up, I want to talk about what it means. I think I did write it down here because I think, I can't remember if it was the first time that he said it, that it seemed to really bother Sybil, where he said, the giant Groff was hit in one eye by a stone, and that eye turned inward so that it looked into his mind and he died of what he saw there. And I feel like the meaning of that changes through the book, or it affects more than one, kind of applies to more than one character. So remind me, we need to get back to talking about that before we sign off. But that's pretty spoilery. So I just kind of wanted to stay on the front half of the book for a little bit before we go into the whole thing. But everybody, if you haven't read this book, like Karen said, Karen read it last night. So you can do it too.
Well, I read very fast. There's no question about that. But even a slow reader, and my husband is a very slow reader, it's easy to get through because it's so well written and flows so beautifully throughout the whole thing that, you can sit down and just plow through it and be done in one sitting, no questions.
Yeah. So I guess one additional thing to talk about is that there's a beast that she's attempting to call that she has never been able to call. And I think she's trying to, and her father before her had tried to, and her grandfather, and no one has been able to call the Lyrilin. And it's this very enigmatic kind of, what are we picturing? What do we think this thing is, throughout most of the book? And there's an interesting turn with that. Do either of you want to talk about that? Not about the ending, because I think we should save that for last.
What we picture in our heads, what it looks like. I kind of pictured like a mythical, not a swan per se, but like kind of a shape of a bird. I don't know how to describe it. Like really, like, mm-hmm. I think it's those long trailing wings, just something very like dreamy.
Yeah, I kind of pictured in the back of my mind a really big snowy egret, you know, long neck, long beak, and the wings are, the bird is white, and the wings are, you know, I think at one point they talk about it like draping like wool on the ground. And, you know, so obviously it's very fluffy and wispy, and but still obviously capable of flight and carrying people also is kind of the background of it as well. But that to me, it's a big white snowy egret.
Mm-hmm. I kind of pictured it as a white peacock, like a shimmery white peacock, in that, you know, like the big fan display and that kind of stuff trailing out all the sides.
Pearlescent.
Yeah. So, you know, Sybil does not want to get involved with the fight between the Eldwald, between Dreed and the Cyril Lords. And there's, you know, the intrigue there is that Dreed had killed one of the brothers of Cyril, one of the Lords of Cyril. Right. And, I think there was the idea that when Corin brought the baby, he said that it was the illegitimate son of one of his brothers and the queen of Eldwald.
And then
it turns out
Norl, I think.
Yeah.
And he killed Norl on the battlefield. And that's part of why Corin is so, he wants to kill Dreed badly. Because of killing his brother, who was supposedly the father of Tamlorn, but not really.
Yeah. I can't remember how Sybil determined that Dreed was probably actually the father.
I think it was in the meeting when she called him. It was just kind of like apparent, like in terms of physical traits or something like that.
Yeah.
Is there more to it than that?
I do think that is a factor. When she called him, she could see it.
Yeah.
And then I think Dreed could see himself in Tamlorn as well.
I think it was a couple of different conversations. You know, there was a maid that said, she never left Norl and Rhiannon, I can't remember her name. But, she tried to help them get a moment alone and never could. And
yes.
There was a couple other things that popped up through conversations with different people. I think even the Cyrils after a while realized that Tamlorn was not a Cyril child. He was actually a Dreed child.
Right. And they don't necessarily have a noble hope for his future. You know, they basically want to say, well, we're going to kill Dreed and put Tam in his place and we'll really be ruling, you know, during like a regency.
Right.
And then something inconvenient can happen to Tamlorn and then we take over. Although I don't think Corin would have been okay with that.
Yeah. I don't know that I ever got the sense that, that they would have killed Tamlorn per se. I think they would have married one of their kids to him and you know, behind the scenes been directing him in the way that they wanted it to go.
Right. Yeah. Using him to unite the kingdoms more or less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's more More what the book implies is that they would have tried for a political marriage there. But, you know, Sybil does not really have any interest in that. She is attracted to Corin, and he shows up. I think he saw Guild the dragon flying, and so yeah. The dragon messed him up a little bit, and then she heals him up with the help of Melga, and there's the attraction there, but Sybil is not able to, you know, sort of like give her heart to somebody who is bent on killing the father of her child, right? Even though he's not really her child, but she's protective enough of Tam that she won't back anything that will cause negative impact to him.
I don't think she's very good at understanding what love is because she didn't experience, she didn't have a mother growing up. Her father was, you know, a distant wizard. And he died very young when, she, you know, she was young. She met Melga only after she had Tamlorn to raise. So I think it was very hard for her to understand her feelings and to be able to say, this is like, this is love, this is lust. You know, what is it exactly? You know, at one point she said, you know, she supposedly loved Dreed, but only because he was powerful. Mm-hmm. And I was very confused about that. But, you know, she understood she's attracted to powerful people. And that was her attraction to Dreed. I don't know that she actually really loved him per se. And Corin, I think she was feeling something for him that she didn't know what it was or how to necessarily return it or explain it.
I think at that point, yeah, she was pretty angry at him because she thought he was going to take Tam away. I don't know that she knew that Tam was Dreed's son yet at that point. I don't remember. But yeah, I'm basically concurring that, yeah, it was a combination of she's like actively mad at him and also is just her heart is so guarded because, I mean, she knows that she's in the world below, that she's a powerful piece and she doesn't want to be used and she's happy to be alone with her animals. And that combined with the fact that she hasn't any experience with love, not even that much within a family. Yeah, she just didn't know what she was doing. Yeah.
Yeah, and Corin several times calls her Ice Lady or something like that.
With eyes as black as Dreed's heart. So romantic.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, though, before they can really get together at all, Corin basically has to renounce the vengeance for Norrell.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, okay, fine. I will give up my wanting to overthrow Dreed, you know, for the love of this lady, mm-hmm. which is nice. And we're making this sound like a romance novel. It's not. But there is a nice romantic plot to it, too.
Like, it isn't a romance story, but it's also one of the best romance stories at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's done more through actions in terms of, you know, not so much as it is partly what they say, but it's the actions, what they do. Corin is the best at it in the fact that he constantly does things that show her how much he cares and that it's a real caring and a real love and not something based upon what she can do for him or something like that. So it comes across really nicely, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a romance novel, but it has romance involved because it's how they treat each other that's romantic.
Yeah. And that's maybe a good time to pivot and talk about Dreed's fear and what that leads him to, because at some point he said, you know, look, come down to Eldwald with me. I'll make of you a queen. You know, you're already the mother of my child, essentially. And she's like, no, I'm not going to get involved in those affairs. So no, forget it. But he's scared enough of her that he decides he needs to more or less tame her. And that's where he brings in Mithran, the evil wizard. And it's an interesting moment when Sybil realizes that she's being called, mm-hmm. but the call isn't yet to the point where she can't resist it, but she knows that it's happening.
Yeah, that's scary. I mean, and that's what Dreed is afraid of. You know, I mean, it illustrates his fear of what she can do, and now it's happening to her.
Yeah, and that's kind of the first little bit, I think, of the eye turning around and looking within from Siren, where she realizes, oh, this is what I do to people and the beasts as well.
Yeah,
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about that. Rachel, do you want to talk a little bit about that confrontation or what occurs?
Oh, this is like the juicy part of the story.
Yeah, this is the good stuff.
Right. So she's in her house and she knows she's being called, and it's like this voice in her head, and she wants to resist it, but she can't. And I've probably read it not as recently as you guys, but right. She kind of loses awareness of what's happening to her. Yeah. And then the narrative kind of switches to this kind of very pulled back, like she's riding through these villages and we don't really get her perspective. We just kind of see this happening to her, and she ends up at this tower, I believe. And she's taken in, and there's this wizard named Mithrin. And I'm not going to get the exact order of things correct, I don't think, but he has Tur the Falcon, which she had given to Tam to protect him. So now Tam's like not being protected, and she finds that he has taken Tur the Falcon's mind because she can no longer communicate with the Falcon. And Mithrin kind of tells her what's going to happen, which is so creepy and gross, right? And he kind of tells her, like, look, I've been hired by Dreed, and he wants you to marry him. Like, part of Dreed's fear is both that she has this power, that she could call him, but also Dreed knows that she's falling for Corrin, even if she doesn't know it. And he's afraid now Cyril's going to have her power. Like, she's going to be on their side and an enemy. So Dreed wants her as his wife, and since she's not willing to do it willingly, he wants to take her by force. And what that's going to look like is that Mithrin is going to use that same power that Sybil has to warp her mind and turn her into, basically, she's not going to exist inside herself anymore. She's going to become this like puppet queen for Dreed to use her powers as he wishes without, and she's just going to feel happy about it and go along with everything willingly. And just not even be aware of herself anymore, which is terrifying. And then like Dreed comes in, and there's a confrontation there. I don't recall the exact what goes on between Sybil and Dreed, but it's just kind of a like last, like she's just begging him. I think she says like, I'll please don't do this to me. I will marry you. I'm willing to do it. I'll bear your sons. I'll do whatever you want. Just don't take my mind. And Dreed's just like, I can't trust you. Like, I trusted my last wife and look where that got me. So I can't, like, sorry, but this is how it has to be done. So then he leaves. And then there's an interesting exchange where Mithrin kind of admits like he's enamored by Sybil and her power. And he starts to make her offers as well and be I think he means to... Does he mean, no, he doesn't, he's not going to take her mind, but he wants her, or does he?
Yes, he does. But he also thinks he's better than Sybil, so he doesn't need to take her mind away because he's more powerful.
Okay, so right. So it's like if you're with me, then you can have your mind, but then you're with me, sort of a thing, right?
And yeah, because otherwise he could call her anytime and she knows it.
Right. Yeah. So then she's put in this position where she has to choose between the lesser of these two evil situations. And I forget what triggers her, but she recalls the Blammer, which had come up in the story earlier with Corrin. So she recalls that she says the word Blammer, and this creature that is tied to her somehow appears. And the idea is that when the Blammer comes to you, basically you see all of your worst fears and you die of them, which kind of goes back to the Siren story. Mm-hmm. So then Mithrin is destroyed that way, and Sybil simply walks out of the tower and I believe returns back to her home.
Yeah.
To Malgus first, yes.
Right. Yeah. And you know, she's been victimized here. And the critical moment is when Mithrin is you know, considering her as a potential mate and gets sort of horned up and loses his concentration because he's of how attracted he is to her. And that's when her his concentration wanes, then her will pops out and she says Blamor, right? That's the moment he loses concentration, and that's the end of him.
Yeah.
And I like that Tur is then immediately freed as well, mm-hmm. and says, Shagogit Dreed. And, yeah. And I love that Sybil's just like, no, Dreed is mine. And that's when it kind of spins out into the second half of the book, where what are her motives for marrying Corin? And it's clearly she's working her own game through it and doing some maybe not very nice things.
Oh yeah, she's definitely becomes a very gray character at that point. And even, yeah, she goes to Mirva's house and Corin comes and she tries to seduce him a little, right? Like her top slips off, sort of a thing. Mm. And I think later in the book, she says something about that, like about how she wanted him to want her the same way Mithrin wanted her or something like that. Like, and I think he slaps her. Spoiler
alert. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, but like, yeah, that really enrages him. Yeah, and yeah, it was interesting reading this in junior high.
Yeah.
My book says it's ages 12 and up, and my daughter's 12 now. I'm like, oh, I don't know. Because that one scene, like, it didn't quite register the same reading it as a 13-year-old as it does now. And the weight of everything that's happening and how kind of rapey it all was.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a big message about consent in the book, mm-hmm. Which is way ahead of its time for 1974. But yeah, she doesn't tell Corin exactly what happened. I think she tells him about the wizard, but she does not tell him that it was Dreed that hired the wizard. Because she knows, he would have just snapped and raised the city, or something. And she wanted her own vengeance.
Right.
Which on one hand, I'm kind of like, okay, I get it. You want to do your own thing. You don't want to be like, well, I got to have a man do my fighting for me. No, she definitely doesn't need that.
Yeah, well, even like you said, like even Tur offered. She's like, yeah, this is mine. Yeah.
So I really enjoy when she moves down to Cyril, and then they create a space for the animals to all come, and just the reaction of all the folks down there. Like, I think you said earlier, Karen, that we were talking about the characters and how well drawn they are, and the brothers all kind of have their own personality. So Rock and Aorth and Seneth, I think, which is a little, that dances a little close to the line with Corin and Cyril mixing up the names. But he's a minor enough character that it's okay. But Rock is kind of the head of them, right? Yeah. He's the eldest brother, right?
Right. The Lion of Cyril.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's a character that I really enjoy. And her time in Cyril is sort of peaceful, but all along she has a plot going on. And she clearly is scheming behind the scenes and saying, okay, you know what? I can get the lords that wouldn't support you in your previous war. I can bring them here and we can work that magic on them. And that's what kind of tips the balance toward the Cyril lords against Dreed.
I think it's very telling that at one point Maelga walks, and she has kind of kept throughout time an eye of, pulse of what's going on. And she walks all the way from her hut to Cyril to see Sybil to say, what's going on?
Yeah.
And Sybil says, oh, come in and stay inside. She's like, no, I don't want to stay inside. She says, well, I'll bring you food out here. And then she gets the food and brings it back out again. And Maelga's already left.
Yeah.
Because Maelga's like, And I think it's Sirin or one of them had spoken with Maelga while she was there. And Maelga's just like, who are you, Sybil? This is not who you are. And this is so awful. I can't even stick around to see you anymore. And I think that's one of the first, I know that there's in the back of Sybil's mind, she's been realizing that what she's doing is not right. It's hurting Corin. It's hurting herself. And the animals also, Sirin and a couple of the others have said, something. But when Maelga comes and then walks away, I think that's the first real whack against Sybil that she starts to say, oh, you know, maybe this isn't really how I should be handling this.
Yeah. And she's also during that, you know, once they start kind of mustering the other armies in, Corin's not stupid. And and they kind of try and keep him distracted, but all of a sudden Sybil realizes he knows what's going on here, and she makes the decision to go into his mind and remove that question, and send him back to his room, you know, and that is kind of her rock bottom, or like she's on the tipping point of becoming an evil sorceress.
Mm-hmm.
So. I don't remember what drives her decision to, she just kind of starts becoming more introspective and realizing that, okay, what I'm doing here is wrong. She deeply regrets what she did to Corin. And she eventually has to confess that to him. And that's when she goes back to her home. Right. But everything is kind of already in motion for the attack against Dreed.
She has the dream. That's the last thing that happens before she leaves, of the Wirlen breaking.
Yeah, right? she was upset about taking the memory away from Corin, and then something else happens. He finds out also. So she basically confesses everything to him, what's been going on, and you know, that's also when she mentions the fact that she uses the torn dress to, you know, attract him, and says, oh yeah, I was using you like Mithrin was. And he is like, oh my God, how can you possibly compare the two of us? That's horrific that you would think like that of me. And so she says, nope, this is all wrong. She releases all the animals and says, you can do whatever it is you want to. And the Blamore comes, and maybe that's right before she releases all the animals, but she's forgotten the one thing. No, you can't have fear. The Blamore is only attracted to people who basically don't fear certain things. And that's when he comes. And I find it sad to a certain extent that the reason why she survives the Blamore is because of the Lyrilin as opposed to Corin. You know, I understand that the Lyrilin kind of represents Corin in a lot of ways, but I also was a little bit sad that that's what saved her from the Blamore was the Lyrilin and not the thought of Corin instead. But yeah, that's when she says, okay, I'm done. I've obviously gone way beyond what I should have been doing. The animals, you can all do what you want to. I'm releasing all of you. And that's when she goes back to her house all by herself. And just, you know, days go by. She doesn't eat. She doesn't sleep. She just sits there until Tam find her. And the war is over at that point.
Is she still calling the Lyrilin at that point? I think so. Kind of.
She doesn't call the Lyrilin until after Tam comes and wakes her up. And then she starts calling again. Okay. And that's when Corin comes.
Yeah. And it's very interesting that here the novel builds to the big confrontation between Eldwald and the Cyril Lords, and we just don't see any of it. And I love it. I love that it just, it's like, yeah, yada, yada. And not even so much
that. You can see all the tales afterwards.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, including that would have just beefed up the scale of everything to a proportion that the story wasn't to begin with. So, you know, it's very fitting. I know like a lot of fantasy novels kind of hover around wartime and battles. And that's one of the things about this, I think, that I liked about it was just that it wasn't a wartime story as a lot of fantasy is. Even though it's there, it's part of like the setting of what's happening, but that wasn't the focus of the story. It was her internal battle.
Yeah. And, you know, the war doesn't really happen because the beasts decide that, even, you know, that they don't seem to resent the fact that they had been held by her for all those years. Right. They still seem to love her. Mm-hmm. And so they decide, okay, yeah, let's do the thing where we, you know, Ghoul's lion, this shining golden lion, distracts a bunch of people and they follow him into the woods and go off and get more or less get lost, right? And right. and that keeps the war from really happening. And meanwhile, you find out from Tam that Dreed has, I think he's died, right?
The Blamore kills him.
Oh, is that what it is? I couldn't remember if that was what had happened, but yeah, like he had when he found the dead wizard, you know, that was just it for him. He was taken to his bed, you know, like he's just declining after that, being eaten alive by fear, and that's something that with the Blamore, when it finds him, he's not able to withstand that. Yeah, so Tam comes and has to climb a wall and break a window to get into the crystal dome to find Sybil. And I like the way the book just says, you know, 7 days later or whatever it is, the king of Eldwald came to the mountain. And, yeah. and then you find out, oh, it was Tam. And so that's nice. And then more or less sort of happily ever after, you know, damage done, but complexities of loving somebody and forgiving them, even though they did something crappy. You know, I think Sybil has a hard time forgiving herself for what she did to Corin, a harder time than he does to forgive her. And I think that's kind of human nature sometimes.
Yeah.
I think she says specifically to him, I need you to forgive me. And if you can, then I can start to forgive myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, again, the words and how Patricia McKillop puts them together, it's so beautiful. Just the way she, and it's not modern language either, but it's not mythical. It's not, but there's certain phrases, the way she says things that you're just like, oh my God, I would just like to talk like that all the time because it's so beautiful.
It's just poetic, yeah.
Yeah. Her husband apparently was a poet too, which I think is interesting.
Maybe he talked to her like that.
Yeah, maybe.
And so at the very end, kind of after they reconcile, there's this moment, and this is major spoilers, folks. So like I said, go read the book. She calls the Blamore again and realizes that its true form is actually the Lyrilin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really, I did not see that coming the first time I read it. And I forgot it, I think, in the recent time until the very end. I was like, oh, right. I thought that was a nice trick she pulled, because the Blamore had kind of always been there on the periphery whenever she needed it.
Right. And she was calling them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she was calling.
Well, and I think the key with that too is Corin says something that, you know, where he says, I've always been here, you know, close but unseen, or something along those lines. And it's that phrase that she puts together. Oh, because like the Blamore told her at one point, you know, if this is not everything, I am not coming uncalled. Because she's been calling the Lyrilin, and the Blamore comes because she's been calling the Blamore's other half, if you will, is yin and yang and white and black portions of him, of whatever it is, and says, I stayed because, you know, you have no fear, but I didn't come uncalled. But it's Corin saying, oh, well, you know, here's this. She's like, wait a minute, why does that sound so familiar? And so that's when she says Blamore and realizes, oh, I can say Blamore because what's going to come is probably the Lyrilin, because I don't have any fear. And now I know the truth that it's two halves of a whole.
So I did want to circle back to talking about Siren and the riddle, right? The giant Graf was hit in one eye by a stone, and that eye turned inward so that it looked into his mind, and he died of what he saw there. I don't remember how many times he says that, but he definitely pulls it out a couple of times with different... I can't remember if he says that one to Corin.
Is that the first time we hear it?
Yeah, that's the first time that Siren says it, and that's what Siren says. If you want the answer to that, then go ask Sybil what's the name she called before she said yours.
Okay.
And that's when she says Blamore, in Corin's presence, and he survives.
Right. And I get the impression that's just Siren having the insight that Corin is someone who could survive the Blamore.
Siren is an awesome character. I mean, I think of all of the, I like Tur a lot too, but I've got to say that Siren was definitely my favorite of the characters because he kind of reminds me of Tyrion, you know, I drink and I know things, and that's, he's sarcastic. Mm-hmm. He pushes boundaries a lot. He doesn't really, he tells you what he thinks you need to know, not what you want to know.
Mm-hmm. So Rachel, did you have a take on that prophecy and what it, or that riddle and what it meant the various times it was used?
Well, yeah, I mean, and it kind of ties in with the more, like we were saying, like it's about, well, introspection, obviously, and realizing, as Sybil does in the story, realizing that you're becoming the villain dying of what you see there is just massive amounts of disappointment in yourself, I guess. I'm having trouble remembering, like you said, I don't remember the exact times that he says it, but definitely at the end to Sybil, it's a very significant moment because that's when she kind of pieces together. I think that happens right after Malga leaves or around that time. So it's that same time where she's like realizing like what am I doing and who am I becoming?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. The way Sybil reacts, she kind of almost jerks back when he says it. And I get the impression that she took it as, you need to take a look in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because you were doing exactly what Mithran was doing.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought that, and I think you said, Rachel, that you do artistic stuff.
Yeah.
A painting of the kitchen in Sybil's house that I'm assuming is all kind of old wood, not the white, but the dark. You know, a couple of candles here and there, and Corin is peeling the potatoes and stuff like that. And Siren is next to him, with his red eyes talking to him. Yeah. And that one picture in my head just stands out that I'm like, would somebody please paint that for me?
Mm-hmm. I've kind of gotten into a little bit recently. The last time I just read it for this and I was like, oh, like I've never attempted to like draw the characters or like put it down on paper what I think they look like. And I started trying, and it's some of the characters came easy and other characters, it's interesting like the way you asked how we all pictured something different for the Lyrilin. I was trying to get the look of Drayne down, and I was like talking to my sister a bunch, and we had like very different ideas. Like we don't even know like what his age is really. Like I pictured him a lot older. She pictured him as a younger man. I don't think it says in the book. How did you guys picture him?
Go ahead, Dreed?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I picture him older, you know, I think he's got grayish or, you know, somewhat gray hair, you know, I guess the traditional king, you know, with the beard and it's graying but apparently he has blue eyes that the horse, they might be gray because I know that the horse that he gives Tamlorn is gray and he names him Dreed, which I thought was kind of weird, but whatever.
Yeah, I think I pictured that Dreed and Rock were probably about the same age.
Yeah.
And that Corin is a younger brother, right? So he could be dozens of years younger, you know. If a large enough family, and there's quite a bit of separation there, so that Corin was definitely more appropriate age for Sybil, because I think Sybil's only 16 or so when Tamlorn comes to her.
Yeah,
young. Yeah,
28. Then when like chapter
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. Well, Corin is probably a little bit older than she is.
Right. And then,
I don't think about it too much, so it doesn't get creepy.
So I pictured Dreed a lot older.
Yeah.
Okay.
But my sister pictured him younger, and so then it was interesting to try to like put it on paper. Okay, like you said, like I'd always had like just kind of stereotypical king with his beard and all that. Mm-hmm. But
it would be interesting in an adaptation, which I don't really want an adaptation of this because right. so much of it is inside Sybil's head. It would be really hard to do. But I would picture Dreed as starting off looking hale and hearty, but maybe in his 40s. And then after the whole thing with Mithrin, I would see him just, you know, age 20 years overnight.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because of the stress of all of that.
Yeah. So if, I mean, generally speaking, and this is speaking as a mom, I mean, generally it's 2 years because you have to, you know, heal from the from having the baby. And then there's the 10 months that you're actually pregnant before mm-hmm. you have the baby. So it's, if you do any genealogy work, which I do a lot of, you almost see traditionally it's 2 years apart between each kid, if you mm-hmm. have them one after the other, after the other. So if Dreed is the same age as Rock is going to be at least 14 years older than his youngest brother, which is Corin. So Corin, at least if he's the same age as Rock, if Dreed is the same age as Rock, then Corin's going to be at least 14 years younger than he is. So it's a pretty significant age difference. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure being king ages you significantly as well.
I like the dynamic between the Sirrah Lords where they all kind of bust Corin's chops about, oh, hey, you saw another magical beast, did you? Okay, sure, bud. Giving him the younger brother treatment.
Yeah, that was one of the cool things, like you were saying earlier, Seth, about when they bring all the magical animals to Searle and they realize, holy shit, he's not been making this stuff up. They're real. And you weren't crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and it's great the way it ends in a way that we assume, I mean, they're already married. They never were not married. Right. So she goes back with him and it's just like, and all the stuff with the war and all the beasts and all that, they all saw all of that too. And it's just, it's kind of funny that they always busted his chops about it. And then he ends up kind of the winner, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and, and has like the magic wife and all this. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel good for Sybil that, you know, she kind of gets, she's always been solitary. And so getting kind of adopted into this big family and you know, she all of a sudden has sisters and brothers out the wazoo. So I feel good about her future.
Tam mentions at one point, he's like, I have cousins. I never knew what cousins were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The real bummer about the book is that this is the only book in this universe. Mm-hmm. And I was really disappointed when I found that out. Cause I thought, well, surely if you're going to create such a magical and well-drawn world, you're going to tell more than one story in it. And no, that this was just, MacKillop did not regularly write series.
Yeah. I don't know that I'm disappointed. I would say I'm glad. I think that it doesn't have more because everything, it's fleshed out in a way that it's believable, but it's not really in a way like, well, let's explore this part or we didn't see enough of it. Sure. Like she just kind of told us what we needed to know and enough hints that made it real. And like I said, it's such a precise story about her journey of being isolated and this whole, like every step of the way, everything that happens is like a step on her journey from being isolated to like kind of joining humanity and learning to love and all that. And that's what the story is to me. It's not a story about, some books are like, some authors do pour a lot of years into developing this complicated world and all these politics and their own legends and all this stuff. And I don't feel like the story necessarily did that, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Cause I don't think that it would have served this story any better than how it turned out.
Yeah, I do see that. And there's something to the idea that you don't have to pull on every single thread until the whole blanket is gone. Right. Mm-hmm. Where we don't need the origin story of, the prequel of Melga and Dreed and everybody else, go back to Ogham and Meek or Mike, whatever her father's name was. You can over-explain things. I just love the universe so much that I want to be in it more.
Yeah.
And so I just have the one book, and I can only reread it so many times in a year. So,
well, I absolutely 100% agree that it is a book that stands alone and doesn't need a prequel or a sequel or any of those things like that. But I also agree that the world was so wonderful that to spend more time in it would be great, even if it was a completely separate set of people, as long as it was still in the same world. But I also, to a certain extent, think that I get that sequel part of it in The Riddle Master of Head, in the same sort of world. And I do note that in The Forgotten Beast of Eld, she mentions a riddle master, which I thought, oh, you know, that's a little bit of foreshadowing that she's going to write these books, you know, a couple of years later down the line. So they're all really phenomenal books to be able to reread again and again and again, as I do.
Nice. I'm going to have to get to that series. I listened to the first one on audio and it didn't totally work for me. It was the one book that I read when I was preparing for the previous episode that I was like, yeah, I could take that one or leave it. But the other ones I loved. So I'd love to work my way through her whole catalog. And along the way, I'll revisit that one and give it another chance.
I'll just say that if you talk about a series where you don't see the end coming, how it all ends up, and I'm not going to spoil it, but it's the best circle to bring it to that point.
I have also not read that series, and I need to. I've only read like a handful of our other books, and none of them came close to
the
level of love as this one. And so I kind of gave up on them, but I have heard a lot of recommendations for Riddle Master. So
yeah, I would say the Riddle Master of Head series is, well, that's the only one. I've read most of hers, but these are the only two groups, if you will, that I read again and again and again. Okay. And what I like about the Riddle Master of Head series is the first book is basically from his perspective. The second book is about her perspective. And the third one is them together.
Okay.
So it's interesting that it takes very different tracks to tell the story as a whole.
Yeah.
That's nice. Good. Anything else either of you want to talk about this book?
Read it.
I was going to say, other than reiterating how beautifully like all the dialogue is written.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of hard to beat in terms of just the craft of it is so good. And, you know, take note, fantasy authors of today, right? You can write a great book in 166 pages. It does not have, not everything has to be a 600 page tome.
It's almost harder to write a book.
Yeah, it has to be so tight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to be really well drawn. But yeah, this is a really, really good one. So big thumbs up and recommendations from all of us.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think that will suffice for a podcast about The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. So Karen and Rachel, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for asking.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do a podcast about Forgotten Beasts for years. And then I was like, you know what? I found that page and I think I saw somebody else mention Forgotten Beasts. And I was like, this is when I need to reread it. Because I'd had that 50th anniversary edition of it sitting on my shelf and hadn't cracked it. So I thought, this is the moment. I'm going to do it. So yeah, like I said, thank you so much for that. Everybody listening, if you want to hear more about Patricia McKillop, you can listen to my old episode from 2023, I think it was, or maybe it was early 2024. And that was a good discussion with Dr. Audrey Isabel Taylor. All right. Well, thanks again to both of you for doing this. It was a lot of fun.
Yep. Great to be able to talk about a book that's really so worth it.
Yeah. All right. Bye now. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion about The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. It's just such a wonderful book. I hope we got that across. We talked a little bit more about the plot than sometimes we do on these, but I totally think it's worth it. And just really highly recommend that one. At some point, I still do want to do episodes about The Chronicles of Brédain. I've been rereading those now to my mom, and they're just wonderful books. So If you want to do a Foundational Fantasy episode, go ahead and reach out to me. You can find me feedback at hugospodcast.com or find me on social media in the various places, or use the contact form on hugospodcast.com to get a hold of me. Or if you just want to do a regular episode, you know, I can always use guests. So I'm trying to plan out the rest of my year right now. So get your foot in the door and we'll do it. As always, if you want to support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. You can support any way you like. But I appreciate you listening, and thanks for that, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.